I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish radio show and podcast with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, your weekly geschmack helping of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and thoughtful conversation. This morning, our guest is Shirley Russick Wachtel, author of the compelling new book, The Baker of Lost Memories. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. While we are still in the heat of summer, last week the peak temperature here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, was over 110 degrees. The fall activities have nonetheless started up. Classes began for all K through 12 schools last week. Sports and arts programs have commenced. Traffic actually increased dramatically around Tucson. And the Jewish High Holy Days are now less than 6 weeks away, with Rosh Hashanah beginning September 22nd. Summer in the Sonoran Desert can be a little overbearing, and the observance of Tisha B'Av last weekend, the fast day commemorating the destruction of the First and Second Temples and the fall of Beitar, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, the expulsion of the Jews of England, all of which occurred on that same ninth day of the Jewish calendar month of Av, well, it's led me down a peculiar and perhaps dark path, a rabbit hole, if you will. This unfortunate combination of extreme heat and Jewish disaster themes got me thinking about the question of apocalypse and Armageddon ideas. It's not that I believe we are fated to end our existence on this planet anytime soon. I do not. But the peculiar proximity of superheated temperatures and fasting for a truly dismal day in Jewish history all got me thinking, well, apocalyptically. Now first, the idea that everything will come to an end someday in disastrous fashion is quite an old one. In fact, the term Armageddon comes from the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, in which a slightly elevated city in Israel called Megiddo, that's where the English of Armageddon is derived from, Har Megiddo, Mount Megiddo, lies on the crossroads between the Sea Road and the road that intersects coming in from the east. And that was the site of many cataclysmic battles in antiquity. The great prophet Ezekiel, not the most cheerful of people, and perhaps the most imaginative visionary of all biblical seers, Ezekiel chose to locate his idea of the final terrible battle of all time right there at Mount Megiddo, Har Megiddo, between the forces of two equal and awful armies. Thus was born the term and the idea of Armageddon. In any case, this Armageddon idea that the world is on the way to a terrible sudden end has been on the minds of a lot of people recently. Perhaps not quite as much as when I was growing up, back when we used to have atomic bomb drills regularly in grade school, as though ducking under our desks would somehow save us from nuclear annihilation. But today, still, we've seen Vladimir Putin recently threaten NATO with his arsenal of nuclear weapons if they intervene further in the brutal assault against Ukraine. We've had the Islamist theocracy of Iran seek to get nuclear weapons in order to threaten and perhaps commit genocide in Israel. North Korea is trying to become a nuclear power with ballistic missiles under its own insane dictator, and on and on. Now, there's always a sense among some folks that we are on the sliding slope to human self-destruction of our entire race. But whether or not there's any immediate likelihood of generalized destruction, it's interesting, even notable nowadays, that a rather strange trend has emerged among super-rich tech moguls. Many of the multi-billionaire tech bros, from Bill Gates to Mark Zuckerberg to Peter Thiel to Larry Ellison, have constructed underground bunkers with elaborate living facilities designed to protect against nuclear attack, and which would allow for years of subterranean life in luxury after the great final war destroys everything on the surface. These shelters, located at their incredibly fancy properties in places like Hawaii and New Zealand, incorporate advanced features like renewable energy systems, air and water filtration, and of course, lots of luxury amenities. Companies that actually specialize in luxury survivalist billionaire bunkers are working today. They have names like Atlas Survival Shelters and Survival Condo. These are now true status symbols for the incredibly super rich who are planning to survive the end of the world as we know it in these elaborate underground lairs. Mind you, some of these guys, like Zuckerberg and Ellison, are Jewish. I'm not sure when it became the goal of the billionaire class to not only separate themselves from ordinary humanity, but to come to believe in the end of that same humanity and plan on being the only ones left alive on the island when the reactive dust all settles or global warming drowns the planet. But it sure seems to be what they're thinking is going to happen. And of course, there are the Elon Musks and Jeff Bezoses who are planning on moving to Mars to start everything over. Okay, look, super rich people are always weird. They have pretty much always been incredibly odd throughout history. The number of them, like Warren Buffett, who preserves some grasp on normalcy, is pretty tiny. If you doubt that rich people are peculiar, watch The Crown TV series, or really any show about super wealthy folks set in any period of history. It's not like the U.S. robber barons of the 1890s were exactly normal folks with happy family lives. Hi there, John D. Rockefeller. Nor were the Medicis a lot of fun to hang around with, and certainly not the Borgias. We're talking about pretty twisted people. I guess if absolute power corrupts absolutely, absolute wealth apparently does much the same, but perhaps in even weirder ways. Now, this obsession with the apocalypse, however, is disturbing. It demonstrates that instead of seeking to improve the world or prevent destruction, the wealthiest people are trying to escape it all, including escaping any responsibility for saving it. A few words on the Jewish understanding of the end of things, the Acharit Hayamim, the end of days. I know, we kind of invented the idea of an ultimate judgment day and a messianic age, but we always, always as Jews, see it as a distant concept, arriving only when God will deem it to be the right time, which never happens. In the meantime, the foundational Jewish belief is that we all have a responsibility to seek to improve the world, to perform a form of tikkun olam, heal the planet of the injustice, warfare, and ecological damage our species has continued to inflict upon each other and on all of God's creation. As Jews, our role is to work to improve the world as it is and seek to turn it into what we wish it will become in the most positive way. It is never supposed to be to withdraw from it or bunker down in some safe, secure comfort and let it all go up in smoke. We are not supposed to fiddle while the planet burns or drowns. Now, it is, of course, possible for us to destroy our own planet nowadays, physically so. I don't personally think we are that much closer to that than we used to be. I mean, the Cuban Missile Crisis certainly brought us to the brink not long after I was born a long time ago, and I believe we do have the capacity to overcome the many challenges we face now, but in order to do so, we cannot simply hide from the responsibility we all have to prevent apocalypse and, frankly, to heal our planet. We have more super rich people now than we have at any time since the 1890s, and they are richer, and they have the ability to actually work to perform tikkun olam to heal the world instead of just preparing to hide from its destruction. I hope they learn this speedily and soon. Play us in a kind of funny version of this somewhat grim theme. Happy Sunday morning, everybody. Shavua Tov. Here's the now actually immortal Tom Lehrer, who left us about 10 days ago to head to his own afterlife. It's his "We Will All Go Together When We Go."
When you attend a funeral, it is sad to think that sooner or later those you love will do the same for you. And you may have thought it tragic, not to mention other adjectives, to think of all the weeping they will do. But don't you worry, no more ashes, no more sackcloth, and an armband made of black cloth will someday nevermore adorn a sleeve. For if the bomb that drops on you gets your friends and neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go. We will all bake together when we bake. There'll be nobody present at the wake. With complete participation in that grand incineration, nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. We will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes by and by. There will be no more misery when the world is our rotisserie. Yes, we all will fry together when we fry. We will all char together when we char. And let there be no moaning of the bar. Just sing out a te deum when you see that ICBM, and the party will be come as you are. We will all burn together when we burn. There'll be no need to stand and wait your turn. When it's time for the fallout and St. Peter calls us all out, we'll just drop our agendas and adjourn. And we will all go together when we go. Every Hottentot and every Eskimo. When the air becomes Uranus, we will all go simultaneous. Yes, we all will go together when we all go together. Yes, we all will go together when we go.
That was the recently passed away great satirist Tom Lehrer's, Jewish, of course, We Will All Go Together When We Go. One of his darker songs, a lot of competition for that title, but also one that continues to have great relevance, unfortunately. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest this morning, Shirley Russick-Wachtel, will explain how she's influenced by her own family's complicated past in each novel she writes, and what led her to write her new book, The Baker of Lost Memories. Meet Shirley when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Welcome back, I should say. Shirley Russick-Wachtel is the author previously of A Castle in Brooklyn. Her new book is called The Baker of Lost Memories, which is a fine book. And also, I might add, delicious. Welcome back to Too Jewish. Good morning.
Thank you so much for having me again.
So are you a baker, I have to ask?
Only with my granddaughters. We do our best, and it's just a fun thing for us to do. I don't have any extraordinary bakes, but it's something I've always enjoyed. And actually, my mother back in Europe, she worked for her aunt who was a baker. So that's the only connection.
Well, it's a nice connection in any case. This is a book that spans a really interesting variety of genres, I would say. Were you aiming at something specific with the novel? Because it's both a grown-up book, but I think it works as a young adult novel, too.
Well, as with anything I write, my focus is always on family. And many times I write about how the experience of the Holocaust, and, you know, as you may know, I'm a child of survivors.
Second generation survivor, we would say. Yeah.
And how that affected the survivors coming to make a new life in the U.S., which was what A Castle in Brooklyn was about.
Right.
And now with The Baker of Lost Memories, my focus is on my generation, someone who has been deeply traumatized by her parents' experience and the loss of a sister that she never knew. We don't often think about that. We think about the survivors themselves, but there is a trauma, some worse than others, for those in the second generation.
So in addressing that question of second generation and actually now, of course, third generation, even fourth generation, that trauma doesn't go away. And I think people don't understand that very well, but it is different. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, you know, with my parents, just a little bit of background to create the picture for you. My mother was one of eight children, and she and two brothers survived. She survived with the help of a guard in Greenberg, which was a labor camp, and the guard helped her to sew the uniforms and also really saved her life by giving her bread. She said, "I'll take you as my daughter." So as I said, she and two brothers survived and came to America. My father's story was, if you could say, even more tragic because he's the only survivor in his family. You know, he liked the character of Yosef in The Baker of Lost Memories. He was in the Ludge ghetto, and my father was a runner for the black market and saved many lives. Unlike my character of Lena, my parents I did not have siblings from Europe. I was the eldest child, and my brother and I were born in the U.S., but we were affected by our parents' tragedy because, like many survivors, they were overprotective of us. You know, couldn't do a lot of things, couldn't have a lot of special activities. There was that strong, strong affection, that strong love, that bond that held us to our parents. And we always knew, though, that there was a loss for us, too, because I never knew my grandparents, don't even have a picture of them. And I didn't have that experience of growing up with the love of grandparents and also many aunts and uncles. It is not, however, all a negative to be a child of survivors, because many of us share some of the benefits that were bestowed by our parents, such as a love of education, an understanding of what Israel means to us as a result of what our parents went through. It was a refuge, a new home, an understanding of our obligations as citizens to make sure that this never happens again. And I think many of us feel that because our parents were the few who did survive, we have an obligation to make the most of our lives. So I think those are good things, and I think that's the legacy I know for me that I would like to pass on to my children and my grandchildren.
We will talk much more with Shirley Resig-Wachtel about her new book, The Baker of Lost Memories, and about second generation and the ways it impacts people going forward when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in Northwest Tucson and the Catalina Foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this summer and fall. Established almost 7 years ago by terrific congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive Congregation, Northwest Tucson and the Catalina Foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org for more information. We welcome members and guests. Always call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is starting up for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in our terrific Torah Tikes program for the youngest kids, Hebrew school, Bar and Mitzvah programs, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with terrific Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Our Swim Into Summer celebration is a week from today. Call us, 520-276-5675. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events open to everyone. Come Friday night, 6:30 p.m., Shabbat celebration services with full music, always followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. Services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. You can also go to our services on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes, and they are extensive, including Hebrew and Adult Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Zohar, the Kabbalistic class, and the Book of Judges are all available in person and on Zoom. Access those by going to BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Adult Bar Bat Mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMC. CHATucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Please join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing and most dynamic Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetcher kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, TOOJewishRadio.com. Streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is a very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify, too. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments all help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One year, David didn't know what to buy his mother-in-law for her birthday, so he bought her a plot in the Jewish cemetery. The next year, he was really at a loss. He didn't buy her anything for her birthday. His wife, Rebecca, was quick to comment about it, loud and long, on how thoughtless he was. "Why didn't you buy my mother a birthday gift?" she snapped at him. "Well," he answered, "she didn't use the gift I gave her last year." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Two Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. As a people, we Jews are good at many things. At kvetching, of course. At lashon hara, at gossip. Telling people things we shouldn't. At eating and cooking. Perhaps most importantly, we Jews are particularly good at asking questions. In fact, the greatest of all Jewish questions is asked in this week's Torah portion of Akev, the third in the book of Deuteronomy. It reads, Ve'ata Yisrael, Madonai Shoel Me'imach. Now, Israel, what does God ask of you? This passage in Akev then answers the great question, that you have awe of the Lord your God and walk in all of God's ways and love God and serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. The big question, what does God ask of you? And Akev's answer begin a series of statements throughout Jewish tradition, attempts to distill from our large moral storehouse just what the essence, the ikar of Jewish ethics truly is. What is it that God wants? What's the true standard we need to uphold to be considered morally good? This section in Akev lists a few things we must do for God's sake. Revere God, walk in God's ways, love God, serve God with all our heart and soul. Finally, we're told we must guard and do all the mitzvot, all of God's commandments. That's a clear and powerful list, but it's actually the beginning in our tradition, not the conclusion of this exploration. 500 years later, the great prophet Isaiah distilled these words into a more concise version that could be found in last week's Haftorah. Cease to do evil, learn to do good, seek justice, relieve the oppressed, uphold the rights of the orphan, take up the widow's cause. Isaiah's version is more practical than the earlier text and shorter. A century after that, the prophet Micah refined the formula again. He asked, what does God seek of you? Only to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. What a simple, clear, beautiful formulation of ethics. And then finally Hillel, 400 years later, a great scholar, just about 2,000 years ago, said it most concisely, do not do to others what is hateful to you. All the rest is commentary. Now go and learn. The Jewish assumption is that you'll adopt at least one of these magnificent formulas in how you live your life. Whichever one you choose, it will be a high standard for how to live, but one that each of us can achieve if we choose to do so. After all, it's what God wants, what we should want too. When we return in a moment on Two Jewish, our guest, Shirley Russick-Wachtel, shares how she baked the characters in her new novel, created it. It's called The Baker of Lost Memories, and we'll hear all about it when we come back in a moment on Two Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
Nearly 2,000 prominent Jews around the U.S. and the U.K., and counting, have already signed a letter to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu urging him to end the war in Gaza. Coming amid a flurry of open statements to similar effect, the letter is notable because it garnered signatures from influential Jewish voices with an extensive track record of major donations to Israel, some of whom have not previously weighed in publicly on the nearly 2-year-old war in Gaza. Among the signatories are Charles Bronfman, the Jewish-Canadian-American billionaire philanthropist, philanthropist Marcia Rickless, Dame Vivian Duffield, the chairman of the Clora Foundation, and Trevor Chin, president of United Jewish Israel Appeal, an important British Jewish charity that funds initiatives throughout Israel. The letter is an initiative of a new Zionist network called the London Initiative, founded earlier this year to strengthen Israeli democracy, advance a fairer, shared future for all citizens of Israel, revive hope in the prospects of achieving secure peace, and improve relations between all Israelis and world Jewry. This initiative is helmed by Mick Davis, a former CEO of the British Conservative Party, and Mike Prashker, the founder of Merchavim, Institute for the Advancement of Shared Citizenship, an effort to reverse the direction of the State of Israel. Prashker, who lives in Israel, said when he launched it. The letter, entitled A Protest Letter to PM Netanyahu from World Jewry, outlines four requests for Bibi Netanyahu: to permanently restore and enable the provision of food and humanitarian aid to the Gazan population, to end the war, to enforce the law in the West Bank, and to commit that neither you nor any member of your government will again advocate policies of starvation or expulsion as weapons of war. The support for the letter underscores growing criticism of the Israeli government from Jewish communities in recent weeks amid allegations of widespread starvation in Gaza and reported plans by Netanyahu to further occupy the Gaza Strip. It focuses primarily on the harm to Israel and Jews of Netanyahu's prosecution of the war and handling of widening violence by Jewish settlers against Palestinians throughout the West Bank. We are under no illusions about the actions and intentions of Hamas, other extremist forces, and the states that support them. We acknowledge the painful dilemmas any Israeli government would face addressing these threats, the letter reads. Yet we also cannot escape the fact that the policies and rhetoric of the government you lead are doing lasting damage to Israel, its standing in the world, and the prospects of secure peace for all Israelis and Palestinians. The letter continues, this has severe consequences for Israel and also for the well-being, security, and unity of Jewish communities around the world. That's true. In Jerusalem, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reportedly is planning to fully occupy the Gaza Strip, including launching operations in areas where Israeli hostages are currently held. Sources within Netanyahu's government spoke to Israeli media outlets about the plan, which will mark a stark departure in Israel's tactics in Gaza. This announcement fulfills the wishes of Netanyahu's ultra-right-wing coalition partners, who want to see Jewish resettlement in Gaza 20 years after the country unilaterally disengaged from the territory under Ariel Sharon. Israeli forces removed 9,000 Jewish residents physically exactly 20 years ago this week. But occupying Gaza has been widely panned by many in Israel, most and beyond it, who see a full occupation as putting hostages and soldiers in harm's way without any payoff, moving away from ending the grinding war in Gaza after nearly 2 years of loss. This week, 19 past directors of Israeli military and intelligence agencies called on Netanyahu to end the war, saying it has begun as a just war, but now has uncertain military aims and is creating suffering without results. The IDF's current chief of staff, Eyal Zamir, has opposed the occupation decision privately. The die is cast. We are going for a full occupation of the Gaza Strip, a senior official close to Bibi Netanyahu said last week. There will be activity in areas where hostages are being held. If this doesn't suit the IDF chief of staff, he can resign. Currently, Israel already controls about 75% of Gaza, but under Netanyahu's new plan, Israel would control the rest of the territory. The IDF opposes the occupation of the whole Gaza Strip, citing the challenges of clearing all of Hamas's infrastructure and endangering the lives of the remaining living Israeli hostages, about 20 of them. Last year, Hamas murdered 6 Israeli hostages when IDF forces came near, an incident that shook Israel and Jews all around the world. This new policy of full occupation comes after ceasefire negotiations with Hamas fully halted in recent weeks. Last month, President Donald Trump appeared to call on Israel to escalate its offensive in Gaza, telling reporters Hamas didn't really want to make a deal and that Israel is going to have to finish the job. The decision to change the military strategy must get approval from Netanyahu's cabinet. Sources close to Netanyahu's government told Israeli media they understood the decision will be made to move forward. We are going to occupy the Strip. The decision's been made. Hamas won't release more hostages without total surrender. We won't surrender. If we don't act now, the hostages will starve to death. Gaza will remain under Hamas's control. Polls continue to demonstrate that the vast majority of Israelis want a deal ending the war and the releasing the remaining 50 hostages, 20 of whom are believed to be alive, 30 of whom are mere bodies at this point. The buzz around occupation has elicited stark warnings around the world, including from very pro-Israel voices. I hope the reports that Prime Minister Netanyahu has made the decision to annex Gaza are wrong, tweeted Dennis Ross, who served in Middle East security roles in both the George H.W. Bush and Clinton administrations and was twice a guest on Too Jewish, by the way. Dennis Ross continues, not only would that create an ongoing insurgency, drain the IDF, doom the remaining hostages, and cement Israel's isolation internationally, it might trigger a tipping point of loss of U.S. support. In other news, President Donald Trump's administration has frozen $584 million in federal funding for UCLA. After the government reprimanded University of California, Los Angeles over pro-Palestinian protests, it then pulled the plug. The Trump administration has threatened to cut federal funds for universities over pro-Palestinian protests against Israel's war in Gaza. The U.S. Trump government alleges universities, including UCLA, which, by the way, is my undergraduate alma mater in the interest of full disclosure, that UCLA allowed anti-Semitism to flourish during the protests. That's kind of true. Large demonstrations took place at UCLA last year, including an encampment. Protesters say the government wrongly equates their criticism of Israel's attack in Gaza and its occupation of Palestinian territories with anti-Semitism, and their advocacy of Palestinian rights with support for extremism. It is true that Jewish students were harassed very severely on the UCLA campus last year, and that there were people marching with proclamations and shouting for the genocide of Israel. However, UCLA Chancellor Julio Frank said, currently a total of approximately $584 million in extramural award funding is suspended and at risk. UC President James Milliken said the institution agreed to have talks with the federal government to restore its funding, saying funding cuts do nothing to address anti-Semitism. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Shirley Russick-Wachtel, who taught English for a long time and then started writing novels. Her new book is called The Baker of Lost Memories, about a young woman growing up in Brooklyn in the 1960s and kind of the homage she pays to her family in an interesting way while she finds her own way. So when you have a story which hinges to a degree on an unrevealed secret, you don't want to give it away on a radio show in advance of people reading the book, I suspect, because that's a spoiler. But tell us, do you know that that's going to be a hinge to the story or a key part to the story when you start the book?
To be very honest with you, I know very little when I start the book. I come with an initial idea, usually late at night. I'm jotting things into my notebook. So I know how I wanted to begin, and I have a vague idea of how I wanted to end. But I would say once I start writing the book, the characters lead me. You know, many a time I'll be writing and I'll stop in the middle of chapter 5 and say, oh no, this character is not going to make it this character is going to die. And I don't know that until the character evolves, if that makes any sense.
Wow. So there's a certain kind of surprise in the experience of writing.
Mm-hmm.
How close do you get to people in your own life when you're crafting these books?
As far as the depiction of the characters?
Depiction of the characters, do you borrow from events that you experienced or other people in your family experienced or friends?
It is fiction. But that being said, I think most writers, unless you're writing about the supernatural science fiction, we almost have to take from our own lives. And so, you know, as I said, Joseph was modeled after my own father, who was a runner in Lodge. And growing up in the 60s, I tried to remember some of the places, like Brooklyn College. I went to undergraduate school at Brooklyn College. And so I enjoy having those memories come back and doing more research on it, and then revisiting it in my book. I also tried to grasp some of the sounds I would hear as I'd be walking down Flatbush Avenue or King's Highway, or the scents, or you know, anything that was around me. And so that is an enjoyable part, kind of putting that down in my book. But as far as the plot, of course, the plot is fictional, but the atmosphere, the nuances, I think, are derived from my memories.
In developing the story, you know, it moves into modern times, not exactly contemporary times initially, but obviously it moves away from the history of being a Holocaust survivor, or the second generation Holocaust survivor, and then it comes back. Again, did you determine that in advance, or did it just kind of grow into that story?
Well, I think that the history, and I would even venture to say that all our histories, whether it's Holocaust or something else, always come back to you in some way as we get older. And so that was, I think, for me, writing the book, that was always present in the background of the book. And I think, you know, part of that surprise, which I'm not going to give away, of course, is that it was in Lena's head without her parents being aware of it, without Lena even being aware of the impact of her parents' experience on her.
So as a second generation survivor, is that an experience that you've had? You know, you're teaching English in college, you're doing other things, you have a life, family, and then it kind of just comes back around.
I have been driven in my life, in my career, because even as a professor, I taught a class in readings about survival, not only Holocaust, surviving wars, environment, surviving discrimination. We read all kinds of things. And yes, that's my drive. That's my drive. I feel that it is my, in some ways, my obligation to pass the lessons on to the students. Now, that being said, I have a very different outlook than my character, Lena. I have an optimistic outlook. You know, some people say, oh, the book, it's so negative. And I'm sorry that they see it that way, you know, because at the end, there is a resolution, and I like to think, as an optimistic person, that all will come out good in the end.
It's funny to me, people always say, you should have a happy ending. It's like, when I look at great literature, there's not a lot of happy endings out there, okay? I mean, the great books of all time from the the Tanakh to the Iliad to the latest novels don't usually have fun, happy stories, right? There's people overcoming trauma. There's people overcoming or failing to overcome complicated situations. There's tragedy. The great texts are often tragedies. That's not a tragedy, I wouldn't say, but it does have some of that power.
Mm-hmm. And by virtue of the fact that you use the word overcome, so yes, there is tragedy, but why move on unless we look forward to overcoming the odds, the conflicts that are posed, you know? So that's the way I like to think of it.
In crafting your characters, do they develop over the course of the book? Once you start them, do you kind of know who they are?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, they lead me, and so they do develop over the course of the book. I just, Lena's husband, Luke, who plays a prominent role in the book.
Right.
I really had the vaguest idea of his character and what kind of person he was going to be. But then as the marriage, takes place, I thought it's maybe not going to turn out so well for her, you know, because just in the writing, that's where his character was taking me to. And just as a little side note, you asked me before how much I take from my real life experiences. If you recall in the book, Lena and Luke meet on the bus, and he writes her telephone. She gives him her number. She writes on his hand, and she's thinking, should I give him my real phone number? Well, that actually happened to me, and I met this guy. I guess you'd call him a hippie in those days, and I was a girl who went to temple dances, but I was intrigued by him. Well, unlike Lena, I did not give him my real phone number. And I ended up getting married to a really good guy. But I thought, what would have happened if I had? So hence that idea.
That's really funny. So you could have gone with that hippie if you'd only given him the right phone number.
Could have, and who knows?
Who knows? The world changes sometimes based on small things, even in our youth. Do you ever look back at the opening part of the novel? Because you write sequentially, you know, you write in order sort of, and think, oh, you know what? She wouldn't really want it. I don't really want her to say that, or I don't want her to think that here.
Again, I think I have to go with the character. Like, it's not, you know, the opening of the novel, I like to, as in all my novels, I like to grasp the reader's attention. And I think the opening does that very much so. And again, I don't want to give too much away, but it's a very unusual circumstance that happens when they're up in the bungalow colony. I was wondering, is this really going to be believable? Is this going to work? But from what I hear and what I know, I think it does work, and it leads the reader really into the story. Now, of course, that being said, as a writer, we know that revision is key. So I revise many, many times my ideas as the book goes along, almost every page. And then, of course, with my editors, we revise all over again until the book actually gets out there.
You've been working on this book for how long?
This book took about a year.
Okay. So, you know, that's pretty efficient for novel writing, I would say. I remember interviewing Marge Piercy, and she would write a book of poetry 1 year and a novel the next year. It was like, yeah, amazing. But you haven't been a professional novelist really until fairly recently. What's your next project?
Okay, well...
Besides promoting the Baker of Lost Memories, of course.
I'm always writing. I write every day. I've written several manuscripts, including one of my mother's story, which I have changed significantly. And the one manuscript that I just completed has to do with three sisters. Again, this one happens to take place... a large part of it during the Holocaust, but these are triplets who go into hiding, and then the journey coming to the United States, and once again how the past kind of raises its ugly head as they go through that assimilation. So that was finished, and now I'm in the middle of writing another one about friends. The mother has a close friend, the daughter has a close friend, and some of the ties they have, and there's some twists there too. I'm still trying to work it out. But no, not all my novels are Holocaust centered. I've written on a few other subjects, but. You know, I'm hoping just keep writing, and I'm hoping that the next one clicks.
From your mouth to God's ears,
oh,
as
yes,
we say.
Thank you.
Shirley, thank you so much. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about the Baker of Lost Memories?
Sure, ShirleyWachtel.com. That's my website, and it's available on Amazon.
Thank you so much. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Two Jewish. And join us at Congregation Beit Simcha every Friday night. Services in Onig Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Always homemade challah, by the way. Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush. Live in person with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and available on our Facebook page. And by the way, the Jewish High Holy Days are coming up in just 6 weeks. Make arrangements to attend. Call our offices at 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Our playout this morning on Two Jewish is a lovely, jazzy version of the Shabbat song, Shalom Aleichem, peace to you, you accompanying angels of peace. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and of that greatest of all values, Shalom, peace.
Two Jewish is sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.